06.
I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Journalism has been undergoing some dramatic upheavals in recent years. Print newspapers and magazines have been losing readership while the public continues to gravitate to the internet, to social media, to get and share the news and stay connected. Some wealthy entrepreneurs have been investing heavily in news organizations. For instance, Amazon's Jeff Bezos recently bought the Washington Post, and eBay's Pierre Omidyar founded an online magazine, First Look Media, which is publishing Glenn Greenwald's work, among others. Today in Radio Times, we want to explore what these and other changes mean for the public and for the press, and we have two guests, including David Folkenflik. He's NPR's media correspondent based in New York City. In fact, joined us from the NPR studios in New York. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, great to join you.
Also with us is Amy Mitchell, Director of Journalism Research for the Pew Research Center. She oversees the center's journalism project and has authored and co-authored several works, including this new one that we're working off of today called Key Indicators in Media and News. And Amy Mitchell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
Amy, let me begin with you and actually begin with the tone in your report. And I would say it's a relatively optimistic tone. I think after a number of tough years for people in journalism, for newspapers and other media outlets, it's been a rough few years. You see some signs of a brighter future. What are you seeing?
Well, that's right. We've been producing the State of the Media report now for 11 years. This is our 11th edition. And for the last several years, we had been reporting year after year the continuing and dramatic declines that we were seeing primarily in legacy media and in newspapers in particular. And you couldn't help but notice this past year a sign of energy, of momentum, of something new that was happening. And much of that was a buildup in digital news entities, both in terms of new revenue streams, as you mentioned in the opening, from entrepreneurs, wealthy individuals, venture capital, as well as luring some top journalistic talent into these outlets. And so one of the things that we wanted to look at was to, one, acknowledge this energy and this sense of something different, and also get a sense of sort of where that fits in the industry as a whole.
And to you, David Folkenflik, do you see similar signs of change within the news media?
Yeah, I think you see it on a couple levels. And I think Amy and Pew have done a good job in studying this. You've seen a number of new entrants of these digital billionaires in several instances and other major folks who, in a sense, want to step forward and take perhaps a more civic role. Bezos at the Washington Post gives us a comfort, not necessarily that they will solve the problems besetting the newspaper industry writ large and the Post in particular, but that there's somebody who's going to stand behind it with a lot of money and a lot of insight into how the digital age works. John Henry in the Boston Globe comes forward with a fortune made in finance and other endeavors, and takes that off the hands of the New York Times Company and the Sulzberger family, who really didn't know what to do with it after sinking well over $1 billion in 1993, and that was early 1993 dollars,
right.
Mentioning. So it was a lot of money. And the hope is not only that people bring their money, but bring their expertise. Chris Hughes acquired the New Republic, a liberal journal over a century old that has nonetheless sort of foundered both in the print and in the digital ages from an economic standpoint. And he was a guy who had real insights, was one of the early guys at Facebook and became then Barack Obama's social media manager in his wildly successful 2008 campaign. And some of these guys have insights, one hopes, that might translate in the journalism world. But we don't know that to be the fact. What we do know is that there's a new energy, a new sense of experimentation at a place that has been older, like the Washington Post, and also places that are newer. As you mentioned, Pierre Omidyar, the co-founder of eBay, bringing not only his fortune, but one would hope his insight into this First Look Media, a new adversarial, seemingly enterprise-based journalism outfit that still nonetheless is, very hazy as to what it will appear like when it's going full bore, and is even more hazy about how it will create a financial model to do it. It seems to me largely aspirational at the moment.
Well, let me pick up on the financial model. And do you think, Amy Mitchell, is it a mix of the possibility of making money, of having influence, of being a good citizen, as David Folkenflik just referred to?
Well, it's likely a combination of things. And as David mentions, this is really the first time that we've seen this marrying of technology expertise and journalistic expertise coming together with the intention of producing original journalistic reporting. So how that evolves and the content that develops is something that we will continue to watch, as I'm sure others will as well. And what's driving that is likely a lot of factors. One thing we continue to see in the different areas of development in terms of technology is that news continues to find a place in these areas of in the digital space, whether it's social media. We find that half of Facebook users are getting news there. They don't necessarily go there looking for it, but they get news. On mobile devices, we've done a number of different research projects where we see again and again that news is a significant part of what people do on their smartphones and what people do on their tablets and their other devices. So as technology develops and as these entities like Facebook and Google want to keep people in their places, in their spaces, sort of competing with each other, news is a part of what people ultimately want. And so we've seen Facebook reach out with tools. We've seen Google reach out with tools and with some grants, actually, to foster journalistic endeavors. This is much along those same lines, where news is a part of people's day. And how this develops in the digital space, many of these individuals have an interest in. And we haven't yet seen a sense that there really is a revenue model that's developed from this. Yes, there's wealthy money going into it. Much of the money, though, that's supporting these digital entities, and this is true at the smaller local level as well, is often from outside of the news product. It's coming from individuals. It's coming from philanthropic organizations. It's coming from venture capital or other parts of that business. So we haven't yet seen a sustainable model within the news industry to be able to support that journalistic effort.
Well, going back to you, David, I think one of the exciting developments is that the public is much more of a player in news, whether it's news sharing. It's just a much more participatory, evolving model.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think the study showed that I think over 10% of news consumers had posted, you know, their own photographs or videos or sent news tips that could go online, that there was a sense of engagement. And, you know, that's twofold. One is that news organizations want content. If there's an accident or a disaster or something else, you know, citizens, human beings are likely to be there before journalists are in a professional capacity. And the other is the idea that if people feel engaged with news organizations, that, you know, they're going to feel more of a stake in them and more of a desire to seek them out, and therefore more likely to be not just passers-by but consumers of this. You know, I can slice this in both directions. You know, people are very much, I think, going to Facebook and coming across news. But if you think back to Stephen Colbert, you know, some years ago, where he had that great line about truthiness,
absolutely,
you know, something approaching the notion of truth but not actually being there, but you think it is. You know, it seems to me in some ways that in a lot of the particularly the newer entries or the outlets that are sort of moving toward news without being news organizations themselves, there's kind of a newsiness where there's content that seems to approach something meaningful, and yet it's not clear to me whether or not it is. And you know, I talked to a guy like Jonah Peretti, who I think is quite brilliant, who is the founder of BuzzFeed and who took it in a different and more focused direction a few years ago by hiring Ben Smith away from Politico to be its editor-in-chief. And they've added foreign bureaus, and they've added political correspondence, and they've done a really nice job. But that is sort of a small percentage of what they do. So you can look at it as value added, or you can look at it as a kind of bunting or wrapping to put around this enormous social media engine. And, you know, Ben and Jonah are very adamant about saying that, you know, things are meaningful if people ascribe meaning to them. So they're fine with using a bunch of GIFs or GIFs for hardcore pronunciators to illustrate from the reality show The Hills, to illustrate what's happening in Syria. And there are ways in which I think that's clever and a shortcut. An editorial cartoon in The Inquirer, you know, can similarly do something in a lighthearted or quick way that gets at a real insight. And in certain kinds of ways that can also, I think, undermine people's need to go deeper. And I I think this stuff can cut both ways, and I think it's a really interesting moment, you know, where we have the capacity to share, we have the capacity to gain access to information instantaneously from our neighborhood to, you know, halfway across the world, and at the same time, because of the economic erosion of a lot of the mainstream media that we've seen as well, there's that Amy and others have so capably documented, there's been also an undermining of the kinds of journalism we used to take for granted.
Well, I'm picking up on that and going back to you, Amy, looking at sites that sort of mix news and sleaze and headlines. And I think part of the message is that the public knows the difference. The public can figure out what's a news item and what isn't. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, I think there. I think David says it nicely when it does sort of cut both ways. And one of the questions is going to be, well, what do people choose? And it, you know, they may first click on that sleazier kind of thing, and then they see a post about Syria, find out at least a nugget about that, perhaps share a impactful image with friends about what's happening in Syria. One of the questions is, if it's not necessarily the deepest, or in some senses it's mixed in with this other content that they produce, are there ways to potentially reach newer audiences with some news that might otherwise miss it? Here's where we are seeing that young people in particular are very active in these spaces and tend to be as heavy, if not heavier, consumers of news in these digital areas as our older generations. And so this, you know, well, younger people are much lower consumers of news when it comes to print and your local television news and some of those other more traditional platforms. So there is a question of whether the possibly less serious news consumer is getting some mix of news that they might otherwise be missing. But there's a real question of how this will develop and how this incidental and mixed in kind of news consumption will end up educating people about what's happening in society and in the world.
About a minute before our first break here to you, David, and you mentioned Stephen Colbert, but it seems from my viewing of television anyway, that Colbert and Stewart do such an incredible job of frankly delivering the news with their very, very satirical style.
I'd say that what they're really doing is they're offering news literacy, in a sense. I mean, they do it in the least didactic way possible, right?
Right.
They're doing it with humor, with edge, with a little bite to it. And at the same time, they're saying, you know, think about the news that you encounter, think about the news that you consume, and be more actively engaged, not in the sense of sending, uploading a video, but be more actively engaged in the sense of interacting with that content, understanding the filters that it arrives to you through, and be smart about it. So, you know, in reality, they're doing my job. They're,
right.
They're, you know, threatening to put me out of business by being very savvy media critics and using satire to do so.
And that's a David Folkenflik, who joins us along with Amy Mitchell. We're talking about the changing news media. We want to hear from you, where you get your news, where and how and why. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra supports WHYY and presents Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, Saturday, April 5th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, April 6th at 3 p.m., featuring young Croatian pianist Martina Filijak. Winner of the Cleveland International Piano Competition, Martina brings her poetic passion and technical mastery at the keyboard. Also on the program, Wagner's Prelude to Act 3 of Lohengrin and Strauss's Ein Heldenleben. For information, millersymphonyhall.org.
Thank you for making the winter campaign a success. This is Ed Cunningham. Last week, our membership drive returned for 2 days so we could make up the shortfall we experienced in February. The result? We were able to finish the drive. Over 7,600 listeners chose to call in or make a pledge online during the winter campaign. We will reinvest those pledges right back into the services you expect. Learn more about WHYY membership at WHYY.org, and thank you.
The Center for Emotional Fitness supports WHYY. Bipolar 1 disorder. You take it day to day. The goods, the bads, the ups, the downs. You take it day to day. Your medication? You take that day to day too. But what if you only had to take it once a month? The Atlas Research Studies are evaluating a once-monthly investigational drug to help people manage bipolar 1 disorder. All study participants will receive study-related care and study drugs. To learn more, 866-DOC-LEON. That's 866-DOC-LEON.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about the state of the media and talking with Amy Mitchell. She's Director of Journalism Research for the Pew Research Center, oversees the center's journalism project, and they just issued their 11th report on the state of the media. Also with us, David Folkenflik, and he is NPR's media correspondent, and he's based in New York City. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Amy, your report did say that most adults in this country get their news from local TV, and I found that actually quite shocking and quite depressing. Why is local TV such a I guess popular source of news for so many adults?
Well, it has been number one for years and years and years, and the numbers have fallen slightly over the last few years, and have fallen more dramatically among young people in particular. But it's, you know, people just have this traditional behavior pattern of you get home, you turn on your local news, and when we did a very deep study a few years back now about local news and where people go for different kinds of local news, the primary thing they're turning for in local television is weather and breaking news, and also traffic to a certain extent. So they're not necessarily going there for the to learn about what's happening in the civic organizations or in their education system. And so that's a question of, as we move into the digital era, how does local television transfer into that space? There's so many other places that people could turn to for weather and for breaking news than a local television website. So how do they continue to gain their ground there? But local television continues to be a very prominent source for people, as does network television, reaching, you know, some 20 million people on a given night across those three networks. And you know, over the next few years, they're likely to continue to play a very significant role. One of the things that we learned in the research for this report was that despite this energy, despite this growth that we're seeing both at the larger national outlets and these local startups, they account for really just a sliver in terms of the reporting power, in terms of staff numbers. We counted 5,000 editorial and full-time staffing individuals at roughly 500 digital-only entities. But that doesn't even come close to newspapers alone, which, even though they've lost over 16,000 full-time editorial employees since 2003, they still amount to 38,000 plus. So it is still small, these digital outlets, compared with the more traditional formats of news in our country.
And David, just picking up on that, and frankly being a reader of the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and these papers have been under assault in the last decade or so. But, you know, they are, these papers, if you read the actual paper, is just so much thinner. There's more material online. But it's sort of hard to imagine that people are going to get newspapers delivered at their doorstep in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think in a lot of markets it'll end up being a luxury product to pay, you know, several dollars a day to receive a printed edition at your home. And I think that'll be a choice for fewer consumers, you know, more perhaps geographically limited. And I think that the price point will end up, in a sense, diminishing by zip code, where, you know, the places that people want such things over time. I do think that, you know, it still is the majority of revenues for most newspapers, or what we think of as newspaper companies, to charge people for subscriptions an ever-increasing amount, but also those print ads are still worth a lot more than what they can charge for ads online. So, you know, I spent time with the Portland Oregonian, which is one of the newspapers held by the Newhouse family. That's the same family that owns Condé Nast, The New Yorker, and a bunch of glossy magazines. But they own a bunch of newspapers in New Jersey and Alabama, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and in Michigan and elsewhere. And they've taken most of their papers to a several-day-a-week printed product approach, where they just say, you know, it's not really practical to print and distribute the paper 7 days a week. We're going to marshal our ads for the most popular days of the week. And we're going to look to print first and then pull from, print first online and pull from our reports things that are most appropriate for a printed product. And, you know, I don't know that that's the best approach, but it is an approach that's trying to take advantage of the digital world. We've similarly seen today news from a very respected analyst, Ken Doctor, that a news organization that most people haven't heard of called Digital First Media, which actually controls well over 100 newspapers across the country, serving many millions of readers and tens of millions online, may well end up putting its newspapers on the block. It had tried to consolidate the production of a lot of its content, and this has been a holy grail for newspaper chains for years. But trying to find a way to do that both online and in print and save costs in such a way that they were still doing innovative content. And you know what? The content was actually pretty interesting. It was a thoughtful way of trying to produce things. And yet, money-wise, the venture capitalists who took it over after bankruptcies, much like those that have affected the newspapers in Philadelphia, haven't been able to make the numbers work. And so, you know, you're really seeing in city after city a lot of insecurity about the primary, shall we say, engine or primary horsepower for enterprise journalism and important news coverage that have occurred in those cities away from, you know, the big media centers of Washington and New York.
Let me throw something else on the table, then we'll get to our callers, and we do have some emails as well. To you, Amy, and you write about the fact that newspapers, I guess, and others are doing this sort of with what's described as native advertising or branded content, the idea that there would be content, in a sense, paid for by an advertiser, but it would exist looking, I guess, rather like an article written by someone. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, and it's a little complicated to explain if you're not staring at it on
exactly.
the screen. But one of the best ways for, I think, a listener to think about it is if you think back to the magazines, that when you'd all of a sudden come across a page and you'd see something that looked like it had a little different border and it was still content, but it had a little slug at the top that said advertisement and it had a blue border instead of a red border like the rest of the magazine or something like that. It's akin to those kinds of ads where it is content and it is placed within the news product. And what's different here is that in many cases, these advertisements are stories that are in some cases produced by the journalistic staff, paid for by advertisers. And in some cases, it's much harder than in others to distinguish between that kind of quote-unquote story that is actually paid for by an advertiser that probably has a little slug like Prudential or something else up in the mix there versus a regular byline piece. Now, you know, this is a kind of advertisement that BuzzFeed has made a lot of its money off of, not necessarily with its original news, but in the other kind of content that it's producing. Other organizations like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal now are moving into doing this kind of advertisement as well. Now, they are working to take clearer steps to distinguish that kind of content from the actual editorial content produced within the newsroom itself. Whether the consumer can recognize those differences and how the consumer would respond as they know them is something we really, you know, haven't had a full sense of yet.
David, does that cross a line for you, that line between money and content or money and news?
I think it very much depends on the degree to which it's made clear to readers and consumers that what it is they're consuming is not from the organization itself. You know, people felt on BuzzFeed, which was a pioneer in sort of the newest iteration of this, had kind of crossed a line. They said, well, community members can post things and certain kinds of corporate community members can pay to post things. And suddenly there was argument over, you know, something posted, I believe, by the Israeli government. You know, and they said, well, wait a second, this is completely unfair to Palestinians. And others said, well, this is, you know, a corporate advertising gussied up to look like BuzzFeed viral content. And indeed, BuzzFeed was advertising that to its potential clients that this was stuff that could go viral if shaped in the right way. I do want to make a caveat, though.
Sure.
You know, it feels like everything old becomes new again. When I was a cub reporter nearly 20 years ago at the Baltimore Sun, I was covering higher education at the time, And we had these special supplements, higher education supplements, that came out a couple times a year to coincide with when parents and students were thinking about registration, and particularly for the kinds of colleges that didn't depend on people applying almost a year in advance to them, you know, community colleges, smaller colleges, people choosing where to enroll. You know, these were kind of service-oriented sections, and I would be assigned to write pieces by my editor, a very conscientious and thoughtful journalist by the name of Bill Salganik, to do stories on it. And there's, you know, I remember writing pieces about, you know, the strains put on private college with certain kinds of construction investments. I remember writing about financial aid and how families were having trouble sorting through it, or how different financing of student loans under President Clinton's administration might affect different programs. But there was pushback from colleges who felt, you know, this stuff is too serious. Some of it doesn't reflect positively on us. And in reality, these sections were vehicles for the colleges to advertise. They existed because there was an appetite, not necessarily from readers, but from advertisers, to have a vehicle at a time of year when people were thinking about colleges. So when they started making certain demands and complaints, and that got back to the newsroom, at a certain point, the newsroom said, well, forget it. You know, that can be done by the marketing department if you guys want content that's not going to be shaped by us. So none of my assignments and none of my reporting was affected by the appetite or the desires of the advertisers. But there was a point at which it was felt that, you know, it kept toggling back and forth every couple of years, to be honest, between who had ownership for it, but it came along with its own tension. So all of this is to say is that's something that existed then for newspapers, and it's something that exists now for news organizations. And the same issues arise, the same principles have to endure. The way those are interpreted in the modern age may slightly shift, but I think that the ultimate one is that people have to be very clear. Is this news content, or is this, you know, marketing product? And sometimes marketing product is wonderful. You read Vogue, or a lot of people read Vogue for the ads, you know, for the glossy pictures as much as anything else. But you have to be aware of what you're looking at.
And that's David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. Also with us, Amy Mitchell, director of journalism research for the Pew Research Center, just came out with a new report on the state of the media. And we want to hear from you. We want to know where you get your media, your news and information, how you stay connected to the world. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, Amy, we have an email from Mike. When will someone like Jeff Bezos begin negotiations with publishers so readers can pay for only what they read? Do you think that's on the horizon? You pay per article as opposed to getting the whole gosh darn thing?
Well, you know, that was actually idea that came about at one point when organizations were trying to figure out, okay, how can we monetize this digital content, which at the time most people were paying absolutely zero for. Can we do a pay for story? Can we pull several news organizations into a kind of consortium and let people pay by the story for that? It's not going to bring in a whole lot of revenue, and one of the questions that's, you know, as newspapers have existed for decades and decades, is that in many cases, the food section, the crossword puzzle, that's what people in many cases subscribe to that paper for, the sports section, the classified ads, and that helped supplement and pay for the page one, the deeper reporting. And so, you know, one of the questions that arises with that is how many people would pay for that really deep, long-form story that is considered one that's really important for that news organization to be able to cover.
Let me get, looks like Ed from Jenkintown to join our conversation. Hi, Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
Marty, I have a confession to make. And the confession is simply this. I spent a huge chunk of my career as a writer, as a reporter, at the Philadelphia Inquirer and the old Philadelphia Bulletin.
Wow.
So you would think that at age 78 this month, I'd be, a print addict. But I'm not. I have changed, and I've weaned myself off of print journalism. The only thing I read, actually two things. One is Time magazine. I read that every week, and I read the internet. I'm on the internet, and there I can get the Inquirer and everything else I want for free. Now that's saying a lot, the words for free.
Indeed.
The other thing that's taken the place of where I used to be is WHYY.
Well, we appreciate
and this
that.
Is not a commercial, but I listen to you and everything else on HYY religiously, and I get a huge chunk of my information and my ability to converse with people from what I hear 24 hours a day on HYY.
Well, I appreciate that, Ed, and that's an unpaid ad, I should say, to you, though, David Folkenflik. It's interesting. He says, you know, here's a guy who worked in print newspaper for many years, and at the age of 78, he basically is gone all digital. And as he says, it's largely free out there, and that's, you know, that's one of the challenges, it seems, going forward.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things you've heard from executives at NPR over recent years is the idea that we have to be able to reach our audience, our consumers, our citizens who rely on us for entertainment and information, you know, in the platforms in which they want to reach us. I was talking with an editor at the New York Times recently who said that 70% of their print readers and subscribers don't go to the New York Times digitally, don't go online or onto their apps to read the Times, and that about 70% of their consumers online or on their digital apps don't read them in print. And this was sort of a surprising statistic to them, but it said that these were, you know, there were opportunities for them, that this wasn't simply the same universe of people who happened to be checking them everywhere. It's that different people consume information differently. And as Ed's case, you know, shows, you can't simply pigeonhole people by age, although there's obviously a greater, you know, affinity for print products in older demographics, but that there are people who just, you know, rely on information, and people who feel that the news is commoditized enough, or that oftentimes, particularly in smaller markets, that their offerings are cheap enough or thin enough that free is good enough for them. And this is something that a lot of organizations are struggling with. The one thing I will say is really smaller communities find that they do rely heavily on their local news organizations and particularly their local newspapers because there aren't a lot of alternatives for them. So these remain vital links to the communities for people in a lot of smaller areas. It's really the middle-sized metro areas that you see that there's a true gap in the kinds of hunger for information and the information that people can afford to provide.
Amy, about a minute before our second break here, but it seems that news organizations, because people are so scattered, are still struggling to try to figure out how to find their audience, appeal to them, and keep them connected.
Well, and I think there are two important points. I mean, my guess is that some of that 70% online only audience for the New York Times, I'd imagine a lot of that is actually international and people that aren't local. And what this speaks to is that for most news organizations, there are going to be multiple different audiences that they need to understand, need to work with, and figure out which kind of content is going to be interesting to them. It's not only online versus print. It is the audience that likes to watch videos. It is the audience that finds you on Facebook. It's the audience that's likely to share and comment or to be one to send you videos that they've taken of news events. These are all different audiences, and we're learning more and more about these differences the deeper we get into the research.
We are talking about the state of the news media. I'm talking with Amy Mitchell and David Folkenflik, and we're talking with you. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Email radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Ed, thanks for the call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY, presenting An Evening with Buica, April 10th in Perlman Theater. The globe-trotting vocalist performs music from her new album, La Noche Más Larga, The Longest Night, featuring new compositions and standards by Billie Holiday, Fito Paez, and more. Buica fuses flamenco, jazz, and African elements, singing in multiple languages and delivering a performance filled with passion and abandon. Tickets for An Evening with Buica available at KimmelCenter.org.
As Russian troops remain near the eastern border of Ukraine, Russia's neighbors say the ghosts of Soviet days are still alive and well.
Once you have a madman in the head, It's uncontrolled power, which is the worst what can happen to any country in the world.
We'll hear views from the former Soviet bloc all this week on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans for 20 years. This year's show takes place at the 23rd Street Armory just north of Chestnut Street and runs from Friday evening, April 4th to Sunday the 6th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. Info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the state of the news media, look at some media shifts, some of the new trends, what the future holds, and what the public wants. And again, David Folkenflik, our guest, NPR's media correspondent. He's based in New York City. And Amy Mitchell, director of journalism research for the Pew Research Center. They just came out with a new report about the state of the media. And I do want to get back to our callers, but just a question to you, David Folkenflik, and this is working off of Amy Mitchell. Report. It looks like investigative journalism is pretty healthy, alive, and well. There are people that are, you know, leaving some news organizations. Bill Keller, for instance, going to the Marshall Project, which is going to be looking at prisons, spending a lot of time doing a pretty deep dive on that particular issue. And it seems in a lot of the sort of prognostications that no one would be interested in long-form journalism, it looks like there's some real signs of life.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, all of this cuts both ways. But I think there are a lot of signs of health and of interest. You've seen, I think the best example in some ways is ProPublica, set up by a couple of folks who left the Wall Street Journal, Paul Steiger, Dick Toefel, now being run by former New York Times senior investigative editor Steve Engelberg. They've done some wonderful work in recent years. It's hard to even think of them as a new entrant almost because they are such a strong presence in doing aggressive investigative journalism.
Yeah, great.
You've seen The Guardian, which we think of as a British newspaper, but actually thinks of itself as a global English language news organization with significant outposts here and now also in Australia, among other places. And it's done some of the leading coverage of the NSA documents leaked by Edward Snowden to Glenn Greenwald, who himself has now migrated to First Look Media by Pierre Omidyar. BuzzFeed has hired away a guy who used to be at ProPublica to lead its investigative efforts. And I think you've seen a commitment by even places that we thought were perhaps faltering a bit, but still trying to uphold their legacies, like the Washington Post, really commit themselves. And this is not only, to paying reporters to doing good works, but, to girding themselves for possible major financial exposure on the legal side of things. You know, these NSA revelations in recent months, almost a year now, could have led to a significant war with the government over this. The Obama administration has been very aggressive in pursuing leaks to journalists and pursuing journalist sources. And it hasn't happened, but they've really, you have to be willing to spend a lot of money on legal fees. And that's something that a five-person startup without a major financial backer couldn't really do. BuzzFeed, you've seen, not only hire this guy, but really commit to doing enterprise and long-form reporting, which you've seen in a lot of other new entrants as well. So, while I think at times it can be fetishized by journalists, and at times it can be, I think, a way of trying to brand an outfit, newspapers have done that too. Even as they've made significant cuts, they've said we've got to keep enterprise and investigative reporting as a way of making clear to readers who we are, of signaling what our values are, even in a time of financial cutbacks. And I'm all in favor of people doing that for whatever motivation, as long as the product they put out is good. The one caveat I'd add, which is really important, is that I just think there's been such a gutting of coverage on the state level of state governments and often local governments as well, where reporters are scrambling to file more often than ever, and there are fewer reporters doing so. I admire the fact that the Associated Press has recommitted funds to send more reporters out into state capitals, and you're seeing some entities, Texas Tribune is perhaps preeminent among them, but others as well, trying to commit to that and doing certain kinds of accountability journalism. But so much of American activity and regulation happen and doesn't happen in state capitals and state houses that I think that's the one warning bell I'd sound amid all these green shoots and amid these exciting new ventures.
Amy, let me throw something else, again, going back to your report, and then we'll get back to our listeners. And this is looking at cable TV viewership, which was down in 2013. Is viewership, cable TV viewership, is that sort of driven by political campaigns, by elections, which now seem to never end?
Well, you know, it's been really interesting to watch the cable audience. They didn't actually have a great 2012, which was the presidential election year. So in many cases, you'd think, yes, with so much of it built now, at least on two of the three cable channels around politics, that's really going to drive audiences up. But they did not have a very good 2012 and were mostly flat overall, and then saw declines in 2013. So, you know, there's a question as to whether there is a ceiling for the kind of audience that's interested in this programming. And, you know, MSNBC had the greatest declines over the last year, but CNN also declined, and Fox had 4% down as well. So not a strong year. Now, their revenues are still strong, and we'll continue to watch what develops there. But I'd like to add one point to what David was saying on the investigative and the local level too, which is that one of the things that we started to see as mobile devices developed was a kind of a re-interest in long-form consumption, at the time particularly reading, but also viewing as video becomes more of a capable product in the digital space. But you know, in the desktop era, people weren't enjoying scrolling, and the time people were spending with any news story was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It was just a question of, oh my gosh, who will ever actually finish an article that's more than three pages worth of a screen? On both on tablets and on smartphones, we find a strong percentage of people that are reading long form and reading more than one long form piece, finding something they weren't actually just searching for, finding it interesting, and taking the time to digest it. Nate Silver's latest piece on 538 about women versus men in movies, and which ones, how many movies have two women versus two men, and do they talk to each other? It's a pretty fascinating piece. It is long, and you know, so you have some of these newer entities, you know, really moving into some of these deeper pieces. And one of the questions around investigative at the local level that we've seen in terms of how consumers may ultimately be impacted on this is that many of your local startups, your smaller nonprofit outlets, many of which have three or two full-time staffers at the most, they are often producing this longer form kind of reporting, whether it's investigative, whether it's around a niche area like local government or state government, but they didn't have much audience. It's hard to get noticed when you only produce maybe two or three pieces in a given week. What we're starting to see a little more of is a sharing of content between potential, you know, either the local newspaper or the local public radio station, some of these niche outlets where there is an opportunity for some of this kind of content to reach consumers at a broader level. And I would just add that we are actually in the midst of a very, very deep study on the boots on the ground when it comes to state government reporting. And so we will hopefully be able to share some data on that in the near future.
Such an important focus of the news. We have a tweet from DJ. The future of journalism should be focused on activating readers to action. People want to interact and not be passive. David, do you agree with that? And do you see that happening? A more sort of a call to action from reporters and reporting?
I think it all depends on the kind of journalism you're interested in. I mean, that sort of reminds me of the kinds of, news can be generated and executed by organizations that don't think of themselves as purely journalistic or even of journalistic at all. You know, you think of Human Rights Watch, a place where I had some friends who used to work. It's a, you know, some people classify it as liberal, but it's a place that basically, holds accountable regimes across the world of all stripes that oppress or take away the rights of their citizens and others. And, they have people on the ground doing research, doing reports in a fairly thorough, honorable journalistic fashion, even though they're an advocacy group. Similarly, if you think of the alternative weeklies, which have struggled so much in recent years, you know, they did for years long-form journalism, often with bite, often with an ideological approach, and sometimes with a kind, in a sense, a call to action. Mm-hmm. You know, Upworthy is a social media platform that often provides advocacy along with the you know, intoxicating and irresistible headlines of "You'll never believe what happened next." created by Chris Hughes, the guy who also bought the New Republic, who came from Facebook and the Obama social media campaign of 08. So you're seeing, you know, some blurring of the lines. I think it depends what people want. If you read Breitbart or the Free Beacon or other conservative outlets, some of those articles will come with a clear sense of what they want people to do. I think a lot of journalists and digital journalists and social media actors would argue is that what they want is engagement and passion. And people can decide how they want to translate that passion when they go, you know, and walk away from their iPads and iPods and iPhones and the like. But, you know, in terms of explicit call to action, this is what we must do. You know, I think people should take a look at how different outlets played the IPCC report on global warming from the United Nations task force. And, you know, there will be straight news organizations that say that here's what happened. There will be advocacy news organizations that say here's why this is a good report. And some, you know, climate change deniers or skeptics who will say here's why we take issue with that report. And there will be some political figures who are doing a kind of journalism who nonetheless will say, well, this is what we must do in light of what we see in the report. So I think, you know, your listeners is entitled to react to it how he wants to. What I think that you see from social media and digital media figures is a desire to tap into passion and engagement rather than necessarily activism, although, as I say, with places like Upworthy, there's some of that too.
Let me get back to our listeners at 1-888-477-9499. We have Paul from Hamilton joining us on Radio Times. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marty. Hi there. Back in the 90s, I used to read the New York Times, and then when they basically misrepresented the facts, what was going on in Kosovo, and I saw the cheerleaders over on their editorial board clamoring for war, I basically decided, why should I fund people whose views run exactly opposed to mine? And so I've gone to alternative media sources like InfoWars with Alex Jones and Republic Broadcasting Network on the Internet, because I'm basically a dissident, American.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the media is losing, the mainstream media is losing listenership and readership to alternative websites because they're alienated from the editorial staff that pushes their political agenda, which a lot of people don't agree with. And so I just don't fund it anymore.
I hear you.
Although I listen to WHYY.
I was just going to say, but you listen to WHYY and Paul. We appreciate that. Amy, let me take his question or his observation, because I do think that people do gravitate to places that where they find like-minded people. I don't think there's anything, you know, wrong or even shocking about that. And obviously, Paul, he didn't like what he saw at the Times, and he went elsewhere. And now there's so many choices on top of that.
That's right. Certainly, one of the things that the digital era has created is more of an opportunity to choose your own mix, right? Mm-hmm. To decide whether you want to get your local, you know, news from your local entities, whether you want to find a niche outlet that really thinks along the same lines as you do, whether you want to be exposed to different kinds of views to help inform your own view. There's opportunity to find the kind of news that you want. It takes certainly somebody who's interested in spending time and is devoted to news and news consumption to seek those places out and to find the ones that they're interested in. You know, we did find in our research on Facebook and news that people do get bothered by political statements that either agree or disagree with their own views if people are sort of too staunch in what they're saying in that social space. And anecdotally, we had people tell us that, you know, they often try to tone it down or only share their views about certain things with some of their friends and not others, because they think others, you know, might not care to necessarily be exposed or take the time to want to get involved in that kind of content. But this question, and particularly it's a big one hanging over social media, is in the circles that we make and the algorithms as well. It's twofold. It's both the people that we decide to have in our networks, whether it's on Facebook or on Twitter or any one of these others, and are they thinking and sharing stories that are very much along the lines of what we ourselves already think? And then does the algorithm and the way that that works also in some cases exacerbate that, so continue to only give us those kinds of things that they're interested in? So the flip side is, are we no longer exposed to things that might be
challenge
off the beaten path of what we're not, right, or challenge our own way of thinking?
David, we're almost out of time here, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but do you think, we've been talking about these diverse outlets, do you think the new newsrooms, even the digital newsrooms, are they more diverse? Are they more racially diverse? Are there more women? Do we know the answer to that question?
I think it would, take a survey of this scope and piercing insight of the kind that Amy produces to really know. But there's been an outcry in recent weeks over the question of, gosh, there are all these, adoring profiles of Ezra Klein's Vox and Nate Silver's 538 and all these startups that. And for that, that first look. And in fact, there's some of the replacements at places like Wonk Blog for the Washington Post, where Ezra Klein bounced from, and from the New York Times, which is creating a replacement political vertical called The Upshot, and a feeling that perhaps they weren't balanced in terms of women and were not reflecting enough. And there's been that's actually sparked a very interesting discussion among digital journalists about that very issue. I would point out it's a little unfair to Vox and Ezra Klein, who's actually not the only founder of it. There's Sarah Cliff and others there who have been important to that. But what I really would say is that I think it's interesting to bring youth into the mix in senior levels of some of these startups. And I think it's affecting not only the choices of what stories are stories, but how those stories are told. And I think it's affecting the ability of consumers of a younger age to find things of meaning, as Amy alluded to earlier, in a way that I think will prove healthy over time for the news industry as those sites themselves mature and figure out precisely how they're going to translate the world for their audiences.
Well, when they're playing my song, David Folkenflik, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You bet.
And Amy Mitchell,
you're
welcome. Amy Mitchell, thanks for joining us as well. And thanks to you as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, and you can stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.